History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories out there that we really need to hear. We do not want them to go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today I'm in Henderson, Nevada, with a gentleman who's going to turn 100 years old in September, William Kendall, World War II Navy veteran. He was at somewhere pretty intense on June 6, 1944, but we're going to start before that. So, Mr. Kendall, you grew up in Boston with a brother and two sisters. What was that childhood like there?
Well, it was, I think, just ordinary. I had good brothers and sisters, and they took care of me. Both were older. I had a younger sister, and she and I were pals. So we had a good family group together. I don't think I'd expect anything better than that.
Do you remember, as that young boy, having some of those dreams that young boys sometimes have? When I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
I don't really know. I heard people, like a friend of mine that came to the house was a ham, and I didn't understand what a ham was, but he kind of explained it to me, and he got me interested in the radio. That was about 9 years old.
So is that when you made your first crystal set?
That's when I made my first crystal. I was about 9 years old. Then I wound up with a one tuber, and I never got to be a learner of the code like I wanted to be, because it just wasn't in the cards at the time. But I think my life back, it's kind of all leads back to the guy that said he was a ham.
And you would have a long career as a radio and television engineer, but in order to do that, you had to survive World War II. And I'm interested in those times before World War II. You know, those of us alive today, we didn't live through the Great Depression. Yeah. Can you help us understand what that was like from your perspective?
Well, you know, you really don't understand what's happening to you at that particular time. When you look back at it, you say, see, things were tough, but you live through them. It's just like the weather in Boston, you know. We're all used to it, but we go back there now, we're crazy because we can't stand the humidity, for example. It's all relative. I dream of a lot of things that I did when I was a youngster because I have a pretty good memory of those days. It was a good life. I had good parents. But I was kind of a dummy in school. I wasn't very smart in school.
Were you a Boston Red Sox fan?
No, I was a Braves fan. My brother was a Red Sox fan. So we had a little competition there between the two.
Yeah, a lot of people today don't even know that the Braves were in Boston in those days.
And also the Redskins football team was in Boston. And I attended both of them.
You know, another thing we think of, Pearl Harbor in December 7th, and everybody has a memory of that. But I'm wondering, for you, being in Boston on that Atlantic coast, if even before Pearl Harbor, was there a sense, an anxiety about U-boats in the Atlantic? And were you aware of some of what the Germans were doing out there?
We've read a lot of news in the paper about the war and things happening in Europe, and the Pacific was kind of a back page at the time, because it was all about Germany and the fighting in the Atlantic Ocean, and reading all about how the Germans invaded France and made the British go back to the Isles with their army that survived. That was all newspaper information at the time. And a little bit of radio. Radio wasn't so much in the news department as it is today.
And when did you start to figure out that you may end up becoming part of these military actions around the globe?
Well, I think when Pearl Harbor happened, we knew we were in it, and it was realizing we had a short time to be called up, and my call was about 4 months later. I got the notice from the draft board, and I talked to my brother, and he said, I tell you what I do, why don't we both go down and sign up? And he said he likes the Marines. They have wonderful looking uniforms. So we both went down to join the Marines, and they turned us both down because we were both underweight. I weighed 135 pounds, and I was 6'1", so it's kind of a lanky little guy. He decided not to join, and I joined the Navy instead because I didn't want to wind up in the Army.
And I know he became a paratrooper later on as well. What about December 7th? Do you remember that day? Do you remember where you were? How did you find out?
I was actually in the cities in Roebuck, and I heard the president. I think everybody was sort of expecting it anyway, but maybe not quite that soon. But we were still out of the war at the time.
So you and your brother both try to join the Marines. They turn you both down. He ends up as a paratrooper. You end up in the Navy. Did you have an idea of what you were going to do or what you wanted to do in the Navy?
Well, in boot camp, they gave us a choice of what we wanted to do after we finished training. And I put in, I'd like to be a gunner on a merchant marine. But I found out that they assigned me to the University of Chicago and the radio school. So they took my background and decided it for me. So I wound up going to 6 months to the University of Chicago and wound up finally learning the code.
There were some other things going on at the University of Chicago at that time. Isn't that where they were working on the Manhattan Project?
Apparently they were, but we didn't know what was going on.
Nobody did.
No.
Yeah. So they trained you in Morse code, in radio. Was that a challenge for you, or did it come naturally?
That came out pretty well. That was my good subject. So I wound up number 16th in my class of about 200. But I was very fortunate. The first 15 went to Navy training for aircraft, and they all wound up in PBYs, and a lot of them didn't make it. So I was shipped to Norfolk, Virginia, and wound up being assigned to the 2nd Beast Battalion.
Yeah, so you're saying that if you had been one spot higher in your class, you would have been sent in naval aviation flying on one of these seaplanes. And in your mind, that would have been a more dangerous duty for you?
Oh, yeah. I understood a lot of those students didn't survive the war. More than half of them, I understand.
And the only reason I seem a little puzzled by that is I know some of the places you were, and you made some landings where a lot of people were killed, at Sicily and at Normandy, and you ended up in the Pacific. So where did they send you from there, though, after that training was complete?
Well, I went to Norfolk, Virginia, and that's when they put us in the 2nd Beast Battalion. We then shipped out to North Africa, arrived in Oran during an air raid, incidentally. But we wound up in a field where the Army was located, and they sent out half a helicopter to everybody in coveralls. We didn't know what was going on, and we found out we'd be good trained by the Army, and they did a pretty good job.
And some people listening probably have never heard of the 2nd Beach Battalion, so they may not understand what the role of a beach battalion is. Can you help us understand that bigger picture and also what your role in that unit was?
Well, our role was to land and set up the beaches for the assault troops. And we did that in Sicily and in Normandy.
And you had to establish some radio communications when you landed? Was that your specific role?
We had a little generator that came with us, and we had communications with the ships at sea. Of course, the whole thing was to get ashore and survive.
Yeah, and that was no small feat. And I know this is a long time ago, but you told me your memory is really sharp for those years. So I'm wondering if you remember just that journey over from Norfolk to North Africa. Was there some concern about German submarines or your convoy being attacked?
Well, I think there was some, as I understand, they were attacked. One of the ships was damaged, I understand, in the convoy. So I guess we did pretty good going across without being hit.
And did you have any thought in your mind as you're leaving the only country you've ever known and you're heading overseas, was there a concern in your mind that you might not come back?
No, I don't think so. It might have been, but I don't recall. I know the Army kind of brainwashed me, so you kind of lose the feeliness that goes that I probably had prior to that. So things are a lot different when you're trained, particularly to do a thing. You do it automatically.
What was the first moment where it sank in for you that this is war, and you saw the side of war that includes death and destruction, and it's real?
Yeah, well, I know when we get ready to land in Sicily, we were put on an LST, which has small boats where we all loaded into, and then supposed to drop into the water. Well, the boat that I had me in went to the level of the ship deck and stopped, and the boat kind of swung out from the ship three or four times until someone found the trigger, and it dropped into the water about 10 feet. So, and as we hit, a couple of spotlights came in from the shore. We thought that was maybe the end of it. But they knocked that off, and we landed. And as we hit the beach, the ramp wouldn't go down because it was damaged during the hit against the side of the ship. So I was pretty well covered with it. I had a submachine gun and a lot of ammunition, so I couldn't get over the top like the other guys did. So I finally, the ramp got down about 25 inches maybe, and I squeezed through that. And I was kind of getting stuck in the V of the ship with my foot. Well, the guy put it in reverse, and he threw me off. So I landed in the water about 3 or 4 feet.
This is your first landing, and this is Sicily. You know, we hear all this about D-Day, and now here's the 75th anniversary of D-Day, but not too many people know what you guys did at Sicily, which was a long time earlier. This is 1943. So I'm just trying to understand here. It kind of sounds like a nightmare.
It was a nightmare. That when we fell, it left my stomach, and we all threw up because we hit them so hard.
So you're in this landing craft, and you're swinging back and forth, crashing into the side of the ship, and then you finally drop and smack into the water. And so you're saying that jiggles you all up and disorients you?
We're maybe 3 or 4 minutes late getting going because of that. So we were the tail end of the group going in. But we all made it pretty well.
But then you're trying to get out of this boat, and the ramp is stuck.
Yeah,
and you say they just wedged it down enough where you could squeak through the opening between the ramp and the ship?
Just squeeze through.
And then you said your foot got caught. So then when the boat pulls back, you spill into the water. What did you see when you picked yourself up out of the water? What was going on around you?
Well, there was a lot of gunfire going on. It seems a lot of what they call the bullets you can see. We've been shot at pretty heavily as we're landing, but it seemed to be all above the boat. And when I actually landed, we saw the barbed wire on posts, and in our briefing, it didn't tell us anything about the barbed wire. But I met a couple of guys, and they had Bangalore torpedoes, which gives you about 16 feet of explosives. And they put them through the barbed wire and exploded, and we got away up through the beach. But it was a little hectic at the time, and we all survived. One of our group was shot by, I think he was shot by one of the Army guys. He's the only casualty I remember. It was a struggle to get there, but it was pretty good, and we settled down fairly fast.
I'm just imagining. I mean, you're a pretty young guy at this point.
23 years old, yeah.
You're old in relation to some of the other servicemen, but that's a young man to be going through all these things. How did you handle seeing those things, experiencing those things? Was your heart pounding? How did you respond to that?
No, I think I was so, you know, I always thought, I go back and say, why wasn't I scared? I don't remember being scared. You know, usually you kind of panic when you went into that particular situation, but I didn't. I don't, it was because of the Army training. They took the fear right out of me, I guess. Because I was no brave fella. I was just one of the other guys that made the landing. And I saw a lot of the mayhem out there. We captured a few Italian soldiers. The part about that particular was they were all complaining that they had relatives in Chicago or New York City. Like I say, I survived it, so I was always called Lucky Billy, so that was part of my luck.
Lucky Billy made it out of there, but during the course of that six-week battle that followed, Operation Husky, they called it, to liberate Sicily, nearly 3,000 Americans were killed and more than 6,000 wounded. Some of the lessons of that landing would be applied the next year at Normandy, and our guest today, Bill Kendall, was involved in that as well. You can find photos of Bill then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 99-year-old Bill Kendall of Henderson, Nevada. After World War II, Bill enjoyed a long career in the broadcast industry, starting out as an engineer at a radio station in Santa Maria, California, where they happen to be listening right now on our affiliate KSMA. He would later become an editor and camera operator in Tinseltown, working on everything from NFL football broadcasts to shows like All in the Family, The Smothers Brothers, Sonny and Cher, Hee Haw, and others you'd remember. But those opportunities never would have materialized if the Boston native hadn't survived some pretty precarious positions with the 2nd Naval Beach Battalion in World War II. In a bit, we're going to hear what he experienced on June 6, 1944, but when we left off, he had described some unexpected challenges in the initial landings at Sicily in July of 1943. First, the landing craft he was in was swinging wildly on the side of the ship, finally released into a 10-foot drop to the surf below, the impact of which would damage the ramp. And when they couldn't lower that, the skinny 23-year-old finally squeezed through a narrow opening, only to get his foot stuck in that aperture. Eventually, after all of that, he made it ashore. And so, if you're part of that beach battalion and you go in during the initial assault, you set up the beach, you make sure the radio communication is active, how long do you stay there?
Well, I was there for about 3 days, and then I was ordered to aboard a destroyer, and they took me from that location up to Palermo. Apparently, the Army was having trouble finding operators, so they ordered me aboard the Mayran destroyer. They delivered me in Palermo.
So what'd you do in Palermo?
I went right into work in the radio shack.
Why was that so important? Why was it so crucial that they have someone like you there?
Well, apparently, they didn't have anybody in the Army to fill in. They needed somebody right away, so I was just assigned to go, and there's another fellow with me, we both were. And the one thing about that trip was the executive officer on the ship was Franklin Delano Roosevelt Jr. He interviewed us as well, because we were Navy guys, but we looked like we were in the Army. We had a lot of Army. I had coveralls, for example.
Well, I'm just guessing that had to be a big deal for you. I mean, here, this is the president's son.
Later with the UN, I worked with his mother, Eleanor.
And just so we understand, when you say they needed you in Palermo to run the Radio Shack, does that mean you have to pay attention to the messages that are being transmitted, or you just have to keep the equipment operational?
Well, it sits down and took messages back and forth, and then they should be to a little town about 20 miles east of there, a little town of Terminator Merce, and we set up radio station there and got everything going in that area.
And I know you're not looking to pat yourself on the back, but have you ever thought about how things would be different if those radio communications weren't established?
I don't know. You don't think about those things. You take every day as what's happening. You do your job, and that's about all you can do. As an individual, you're in with a group of other people, so you're no hero. You're no star or anything. You're just one of the guys.
Well, and there were so many guys and so many units, and this is such a massive effort. Communication is pretty crucial, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
So I think you did a pretty important job.
Well, I think it was important at the time, yeah.
So when did you go back to England?
Well, we went from Sicily back to North Africa. They loaned us one of the LSTs, and we traveled to England and were attacked by German planes on the way there. They were testing their, apparently, they dropped a bomb with wings on it, radio controlled. And I think they were experimenting, because they didn't drop any bombs on any of the ships. I think there's only about three planes coming over. But they put a little fear in us.
These are those glide bombs, right?
They're glide bombs, yeah. So I think that was experimental at the time. Because they didn't really put attackers like they normally would on a convoy.
So did you actually see those glide bombs?
Yes, I saw one go and landed right beside a Corvette, an English Corvette. And it just about turned the boat completely over. And I talked to some of the guys who were aboard after we got to England, and they were telling about how the ship was flipped over.
Well, that had to be a little hair-raising to see that.
Well, it was. But when things are happening, you just kind of go along with what's happening. You don't really think so much about the hazards of it, because it's just kind of hanging in there, that's all. You know, I was one of the guys. We had a lot of 90 people in my beach battalion.
How well did you get to know those guys?
I wound up with three other fellows who were lifelong friends. And I knew a lot of the other fellows, too. But there were three that were very close together. But they all passed away.
So you go back to England. When did you start to hear rumblings that you guys might be crossing the channel?
Well, we really didn't know. We were told that we were going to be going across the channel at the time. They just dropped us off in England. We landed and they put us in the hotels. It was Thanksgiving Day. We arrived, so it was kind of a cold area. So we wound up in these summer cottages in southwest England. And that was a chance that I took my first bath of the year. I think I lived in those coveralls for 4 or 5 straight months. I must have smelled pretty good.
I'm sure you did, and that bath must have been something to be thankful for on Thanksgiving.
Oh, yeah.
Are Americans allowed to celebrate Thanksgiving in England?
Well, we arrived on Thanksgiving Day. The cook on the LS team came up with turkey and I was resting, so it was on board the ship that we had our Thanksgiving. We had our dinner that was really quite wonderful. And then they sent us to the little town of Foy, England, which is southwest England. And like I say, they put us in hotels. And that was pretty handy and quite an exchange from living in pup tents.
Big upgrade. And I'm just curious, I don't want to put words in your mouth or thoughts in your head, but you've had a lot of Thanksgiving since then, since 1943.
Yeah.
How often do you think about that unique Thanksgiving?
Well, Thanksgiving really wasn't that much. At home, it was a big deal. But on the Sicily landing, they gave us the turkey dinner on the night before our landing. So that was the closest thing to Thanksgiving. In the States, when we had Thanksgiving, we were invited to families in the area that would serve us. But Thanksgiving was a big deal.
When they gave you that big dinner the night before Sicily, did that seem like a last meal to you?
I think so. That was part of something that came into your mind. Yeah, I think so.
And I guess the reality is there were those that was their last meal.
It was their last meal, yeah. We didn't lose too many because Sicily turned out to be a fairly easy landing. We went through a lot of armament against us for the first maybe 2 hours of the landing. But once that was over, the only problem we had was the German ships coming, the aircraft coming in and dropping bombs. That was about the only difference.
So you had quite a while in England before the Normandy landings.
Yes. Well, all the way from Thanksgiving to June 6th.
So what'd you do all that time?
Well, we trained, and then I worked in a radio, in a communication station for a couple of months. We did, I think, 3 or 4 take us out to the ships and would land. There was one place called Slappin' Sands. That was where we landed a couple of times. And that was one of the times when the Germans attacked the group where the army guys had jumped off their vessel. Their helmets, as they hit the water, broke their neck. So there was 15 to 20 bodies discovered that happened. So Slapton Sands was kind of a big thing for the Navy guys.
And this was all kept secret at the time. This was Exercise Tiger, they called it. And the Germans showed up in their E-boats and killed a bunch of guys. And you were there for that one?
I was on the beach already when that happened. I could hear the noise out at sea, but we really didn't know what was happening. And so that was kind of, they cut us short. The next day we loaded on board. Trucks went back to our base. So we really didn't spend too much time in training on that particular beach.
What was that like to find out that so many Americans had been killed there in a practice?
It was very devastating because a lot of those guys were from the area we were in. We didn't know them personally or anything, but we trained with a lot of those people on the ground before they go on the boat.
Maybe this is hard to remember, but did that change the way you felt about your own security?
I think so, yeah. Well, we knew that you didn't use a chin strap. That was badness when that all happened. So that was about the only thing that I remember about how we felt. That just became a common new thing to do, that you didn't use a chin strap.
Yeah, it's a tough way to learn a lesson like that. What's the first thing you remember about D-Day or finding out that you guys were going to go, that it was time and you're heading across the channel?
Well, they put us in a bivouac area, and when it was time to load, they put us on trucks and brought us down to the LCT. And that was on the 4th, I think, because we were supposed to land on the 5th. I know we took off and traveled along the coast of England in a rainstorm. And daylight came. I realized we were still in England because we'd already returned to the base that we had left. And we couldn't think, what's going on? So I guess we were there in port for about 2 or 3 hours, and we took off for France. And I was in a group of, we were 3 abreast of LCTs. When I look back, we're number 1 on the list, And the, as we crossed the horizon, you could see the convoy going all the way back. So there must have been like 1,000, maybe 400 or 500 LSTs. It was an enormous operation.
Had you ever seen anything like that before?
Not really. The biggest thing was as we were approaching France, the aircraft started fly over all the bombers. It was like a sideshow almost. You could see all these planes flying over and dropping paratroopers. And that was quite an experience to see these thousands of airplanes from all different sizes. And then as we were pulling in, it continued. It was a continuation of planes going to France.
What time did you land at Utah Beach that day?
Well, the ship I was on was apparently one of the older boats that they sent over, so we were sinking from almost the time we left England. I was in water over my ankle most of the time. We started to sink, and the salvage boat came up beside us. They ordered us off the thing and out of the salvage boat. I got on there, and one of the sailors was helping, said, "Can I help you?" And I handed him my carbine. And as I climbed up, he disappeared with my rifle. And I was furious. I went to grab, I would have killed him if I caught him. But they pushed me off to the side, and there was a boat waiting for us to the side. So we got on, we had to get on that, and we headed into shore. And activity started to pick up. Dive bombers were coming in, and you could see the, I'm sure you could see the debris flying through the air. Kind of an exciting time.
Well, it sounds pretty insane, and you described that so matter-of-factly, but what you were just saying was the LCT that you left England on was sinking as it went across the channel. And yeah, you said that like that didn't bother you.
You couldn't get out of the line because there's number one boat, and you're coming through mine areas. We're following mine detected ships on the way over. So you couldn't leave the convoy. So by the time we got into the right area, we pulled out a line, and that's when all of them finally decided they better get it off the ship.
So you're landing at Utah Beach, and you don't have your rifle anymore because the other guy took it. What were you carrying?
Well, I just got a short arm. He'd made some of the guys, and there were a couple of rifles laying around, so I picked up one. And we were pretty lucky. Wasn't a lot of activity on our particular beach, you know. Omaha was a bad beach. I was on Utah Beach, and that was fairly calm, actually.
And we'll explore that a little more when we come back. D-Day survivor Bill Kendall, 99 years old, is our guest today, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this time with 99-year-old Bill Kendall of Henderson, Nevada, originally from Boston, Massachusetts. We've heard about his landing at Sicily in 1943 with the 2nd Naval Beach Battalion, and when we left off, he described Normandy's Utah Beach on June 6, 1944 as, quote, calm. And I heard you say that, Bill, but I've also read your commanding officer's report on that beach on that day. He said there was a certain amount of aimed, manual and automatic small arms fire on the beaches at the time of the landing, and the beach defenses, which included guns up to 88 millimeters, were also active. And he also said the beaches were under fire from enemy batteries located north and south of them for many days after the landing. So he's talking about artillery, machine guns, plenty of stuff flying through the air.
They were shooting at us already, but we didn't have any physical contact to go after them. They were from more of a distance away, but they were on the end of the beaches shooting across.
So what did you do once you got there?
Well, I got together with my buddy. We just kind of hunkered down. We dug a slit trench and prepared ourselves for what was coming on. But things were pretty calm after we got landed. I think they had a few guns shooting and a few shells were being shot to our basic area. But I was probably more than about 1,000 yards away from any of the stuff when it was hitting. So I was actually in a pretty safe location. I was one of the fortunate ones that I really didn't get into the real heaviness of it, because we just hit the right spot. We actually landed, I think, 1,000 yards off of our regular beach. So we had to scramble and get to the right location, and that was part of it.
So there are very few of you guys left who were there that day. What are some of the things that you saw that day on that beach that stick in your memory?
I remember the dive bomb was hitting the shore as we came aboard. And while we were on shore, I think about three planes came down the beach shooting along. And I don't think anybody was hit, but that's about the crux of it. Most of it happened after we're on the beach for 10 or 12 hours. Because I guess the Germans had to get themselves organized just like we did. So it took time.
And you're part of that effort to get things organized. So you fired up a generator and started radio communication?
All my gear was gone. I landed with nothing.
It sank into the drink or what?
We had to leave it on the ship, on the LCT.
Again, I mean, I know you've told this story before, but you're saying this matter-of-factly, but this is disastrous. Here, the whole point of you going there, you don't have any of the equipment you're supposed to use to communicate.
I kind of remember exactly how I felt. I know I wasn't scared. That's the one thing I could never figure out, why I was never scared. I always figured like the Army training really did something to me. It mentally to make you go ahead without worrying about things that may cause you problems.
So you couldn't do the job that you were assigned, and your job just became to survive?
So, yes, basically. And then after on, I think the second day, they opened up a radio station. So I went in and worked with England with messages back and forth between us and England. And that happened for about a day and a half. And then we spent most of the time just keeping the beach cleaned up and bringing stuff ashore. Our group was called a Beachmaster. And they controlled the equipment coming in, the ships, where it should go and stuff like that. So we spent a lot of time working with the group. Actually, in the U.S. Navy book about the, I think it's 100 years of the U.S. Navy, it shows us the beach battalion on the beach, and I'm in the background somewhere. As I remember, I was communicating with phone at the time, so I was just, it's all such a blurry memory now. But we had a place for the German prisoners and stuff. We had to take care of these guys when they were captured. They built a compound for them right by us. So we had to keep work on that basis.
So you were interacting with some of these German prisoners?
Well, I just knew there were German prisoners. I know that one of the guys, the German, wasn't stepping up, so he gave him a little shot with his bayonet. That was one of the Army guys was there. They were guarding the prisoners. They moved them fast. They were under here, and they shipped right back to England.
When you were there on Utah Beach on June 6th, did you think we'd still be talking about that 75 years later?
No.
When did you grasp the significance or the magnitude of what had happened on those beaches that day?
Well, we knew it was a big thing. I mean, with thousands of airplanes coming in and all the ships. As you're crossing the channel, we saw all the convoys that were maybe 3 or 4 miles away and on both sides of us. So you know it was humongous. The thing that really got me was the amount of aircraft that would keep coming and coming and coming. And a lot of them were the paratroopers were coming in. And the gliders, with a lot of gliders, you can see the gliders. In fact, there's one of the glider pilots stopped by the beach, and we talked to him, and he gave me his knife, which I still have.
Really?
Yeah. But he had quite a story.
He shared it with you there? Told you a story on the beach? Yeah. What was the story?
Well, he told us how he landed, actually crash landed. Because once he got out, his job was to head back to the beach area to transfer him back to England again.
Yeah, they were on a one-way mission.
Yeah, they were on a one-way shot.
Well, and that brings up a question, I guess. And I've talked to some of those glider pilots, and they knew what they were getting into. They had a lot of courage. I bet you witnessed, you either saw with your eyes or heard about, quite a few examples of courage during that operation.
Oh, undoubtedly. You don't think about the guys being brave or not. You're just doing a job at the time.
Did it weigh on you when you found out how many Americans had given their lives that day?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the tough part.
Have you been back there?
No. I went back to Sicily, but I never got to Normandy. I wanted to go, but I just kept putting it off. I went back to Sicily with one of my buddies that we both had a reason to go there. And that was a good trip. We went to the beach area where we landed, and then we kind of lived on for about 2 weeks on Sicily, and we met some wonderful people. You'd be surprised how people treat you when you're a foreigner. That's probably the best part about Sicily, the trip back. But I never really had the idea to go back to France. I've thought about it, but I just never could get myself going.
Well, the reason I brought it up is because there are so many Americans buried there.
I saw a program just the other day where they were covering all the graves in Normandy and in France.
Well, I brought that up. I'm just wondering how you think those guys should be remembered, all those Americans who are buried over there in France, who were honored at our World War II Memorial in Washington with all those gold stars. How should we remember those individuals today?
You know, a lot of those guys were friends of mine. So, like I said, we all did a job, and those who survived were lucky. I know we left a lot of friends behind, but that's the way war goes.
There were some that you knew pretty well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's one guy that I remember, he wasn't killed, but he was... He apparently opened his mouth at the wrong time or the right time, and a bullet went through his, didn't even touch his teeth, it went right down his side. So he's one of the lucky ones.
Well, and you've said a couple of times, you were lucky to survive yourself. Lucky Billy. Is there something you look back on and you say, you know, that was pretty close? That was my closest call, or that could have been me?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Sicilian landing was a toughie. I really thought we were going to, because when the searchlights hit us, I said to myself, sayonara. When they turned that light off, it was like, wow, we're going to make it.
Well, and speaking of sayonara, Europe wasn't your only theater. Here you've been in North Africa and Sicily, you make the D-Day landings. And how'd you end up in the Pacific? What did you do over there?
I went to New Guinea with MacArthur's quarters, and I went to the radio station there, and I worked that for a couple of months, and we worked our way out to the Philippines. We landed in Leyte, and that was our basic base, and from there we went to Manila, And the rest of the war was spent in Manila at the radio station. They made me a supervisor in the radio station. One of my best things that happened to me, I think, one of the commanders came to me and said, we want you to go with us on an inspection tour in Subic Bay, which is where all the big ships finally landed. Went aboard a battleship. My job was to go to the radio station and check out and see how, you know, do an inspection, which I did. After we were on the battleship, we went to smaller ships. And I finally went to one little guy that was had a small crew, and he was telling me, you know, you see that battleship? They have all kinds of fresh bread and eggs and all kinds of good stuff, and we have nothing. So I told my commander about it, and the next day those guys were loaded with all kinds of goodies. I always remember the smile I got from those guys.
I'm sure that meant the world to them.
Another thing that happened, one of my friends, they put him in a JASCO unit, which is the same thing, basically, as we had. And I found out he was in Subic Bay. And so I made arrangements and had him get leave, and he came and stayed and lived with me for a couple of days. That was one of the better parts of it. He, unfortunately, picked up a disease from the water in Subic Bay, and he passed away right after, I think a year after the war, he died.
Well, and you mentioned before that your brother's airborne unit was assigned to the Philippines. Did you ever cross paths with him?
Yes, I did. In the Philippines, I found out he was close by, so we made arrangements, and I visited his camp, and then he visited me in Manila.
What do you talk about in a situation like that? Here you're with your brother on the other side of the world, and both of you have been through some crazy things since the last time you saw each other.
It's just good to be with your brother. He always took care of me. He was older than I. He was one of the good guys. He apparently had parachuted into the Philippines, and he got kind of damaged up on a shoulder or something. So he was kind of just not in the better shape at the time we met. But that was good to be able to see my brother. That was after about a couple of years. When I was a lady, I heard a group was coming, so I watched the operation. The guys came ashore, and I had some of them in my old outfit. It was kind of coincidence. I had thought that everybody went to a different job, but they kept these JASCO units going, which is a Joint Army-Navy combination. And so a lot of the guys I was in the 2nd Beach Battalion wound up in those units.
Do you remember hearing that Japan had surrendered, and was that big news?
We all expected there was going to be a new landing in Japan, so when they found out it was going to be, they were talking peace, it was a big thing. So we knew we'd probably be going home.
Well, what was it like to come home after all of that?
You know, you had to be assigned to do this. Well, I volunteered to, I volunteered to write orders out. I wrote out my own orders, so I got myself awarded a ship. I wound up in just outside San Francisco for discharge. If I hadn't volunteered to be a typist, I probably wound up in a different place. So I took care of myself in that sense. My buddy was living in L.A., so he said I should come out and stay with him. So I thumbed my way to the L.A. and stayed with him and his wife for a couple of weeks. And then I went aboard a train from Boston and stood up all the way to Chicago. It was so full.
Can you still remember your family's reaction when you got back home?
Well, we're all hugs and everything. Yeah, that's wonderful when you get to come back and live with your parents. I stayed back in Boston a few months and then decided California was the place for me. Set up in California, finally bought my parents, and they lived in California too.
And you had a long career as a radio and television engineer, which even included some time at the UN. And you mentioned you worked with Eleanor Roosevelt.
Yeah, that was a good training station. I learned everything. You know, surprising, you think you know everything, but then you run into the business and you find out there's a lot more to it than just what hits the eyeball.
Well, I don't want to leave out anything that's important to you, but I want to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. I know you're looking forward to number 100 here in September. What else keeps you going? What do you, you've got a lot to look back on, 99 plus years, but what do you look forward to?
Oh, I guess staying alive. I'm doing pretty well. I still drive. I have the license for another year after September. I feel I could go a few more years, but I'm not planning on anything.
What would you say you're most proud of?
I guess that I survived, I guess it's I can say I was very lucky. Lucky in the service and lucky in my regular lifetime. Everything I've done has been a step up. I'm a very fortunate fella. And I know that, and I cherish it. This is a great country. I hated it at the time it happened, but I look back at it, it changed my life. You know, I'm a different guy than I would have been if it hadn't happened. That's about all I can think about, is that maybe I'm lucky in more ways than one, not just to survive, but I'm a very lucky guy.
Well, I'm guessing that your children are pretty thankful you survived the war, too.
I think so, because they came along 20 years later. I always say it's time and tide. Everything seems to fall into place on a regular basis anyway, because you know the tide comes in at a regular time and it goes out at a regular time. And time is not going to stop for any of us. You know, it's just going to keep on going.
Time does indeed march on, and come September, it'll bring us to Bill Kendall's 100th birthday. Don't forget to head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Bill then and now, as well as some other links related to his story. Thanks so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses going to your heart, you just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.